Some of the most formidable conquerors of all time were those who commanded nomadic armies, hordes of horsemen who came galloping down from the steppe to crash into various settled civilizations. Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, these men were nomadic conquerors who will be remembered forever for both their strength of arms and brutality. And similarly, the last great nomadic conqueror also went down a similar path. This was a man known to history as Emir Timur, Temur, Tamerlane, or simply Timur. From roughly 1365 until 1405, Timur carved out for himself an empire that stretched from Syria to India, from Arabia to the Russian steppe. His armies were deemed unstoppable, his cities the grandest in the world, his civilization as the birthplace of a renaissance, and he himself remembered as one of the most brutal men who has ever lived. And I want to investigate this all. If this intrigues you, then check out the Timur Podcast, a show that covers the life, conquests, character, and legacy of Emir Timur. The show can be found in most places you find your history podcasts, or head on over to timurpodcast.com for more information. And with that said, take it away, Ramsey.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Conquerors Podcast. Episode 4.3, Thutmose III, the Napoleon of Egypt. First of all, I want to apologize for the delay in releasing the latest episode. It's been one hell of a busy month, with two jobs, the end of the semester exams and reports, and some personal matters. I hope such a delay won't happen again, and that I'll be able to keep up the two-week schedule release as planned. Last episode, we talked about Ahmose I, the pharaoh who liberated Egypt from the foreign Hyksos, including the reign of his two predecessors, his reign, his campaigns to liberate Egypt, and of course, his conquests in Canaan and Nubia, which set Egypt on the path of empire. Today we'll talk about another pharaoh of Ahmose's dynasty, the 18th dynasty, one who would go on to lead Egypt to the pinnacle of its military power. Year after year, campaign after campaign, he personally led Egypt's armies to war, pushing his realm's border to its greatest extent. That pharaoh was Thutmose III. Before we delve into Thutmose's reign, I'll take a couple of minutes to talk about the four pharaohs who ruled Egypt between the reign of our two great conquerors. The first ruler after Ahmose was his son, Amenhotep I, who ruled for around 20 years. His reign was more peaceful than his father's, focusing more on the consolidation of the dynasty, on trade, and construction projects. His reign saw some expansion, primarily into Nubia, with new settlements and outposts built as far as the Third Cataract of the Nile. No notable action seems to have taken place in Canaan. Also, the invention of the first water clock is dated to his reign. Amenhotep had no living male heirs. He acted wisely, however, by naming a co-ruler during his last year of reign, in order to prepare for a smooth succession. The man he chose was a general, called Thutmose. No, not that Thutmose. Who was married to a member of the royal house, maybe even to a sister or a cousin of Amenhotep. That would mean that as pharaoh, Thutmose, shockingly, wasn't married to his sister. Just think of the scandal it may have caused in Egyptian society. Our pharaoh is not married to his sister? What a blasphemy. It is here that I'll mention for the last time Queen Eyahotep. Yes, we've reached the end of her grandson's reign, and she's still alive and kicking. The great queen regent had outlived her husband, her two sons, and now her grandson. Twice she had to fill the vacuum caused by the death of the pharaoh, and twice she proved herself more than capable, making sure that her dynasty would survive and prosper. She would finally make her great journey to the afterlife during the reign of Thutmose I. Her greatest legacy may have been that she showed that a woman could do it, that a woman could rule Egypt, not just rule, but also be awesome at it. That would pave the way for several great Egyptian women to make their mark on Egyptian history, the greatest of whom would be her descendant, Hatshepsut, a young girl at that time. One could imagine Deng Hatshepsut growing up hearing the stories of her great ancestor, some of them perhaps from Iyahutep herself, thinking to herself, why can't I do it? Okay, back to Thutmose I. Thutmose I took the throne of a stable, wealthy Egypt, with a strong, veteran army, and despite being pharaoh now, he seems to have remained first and foremost a soldier. After crushing a rebellion in Nubia, Thutmose set out to expand his kingdom. He was the first Egyptian pharaoh to campaign as far north as the Euphrates. Upon reaching it, the Egyptians were puzzled by the fact that it was the first great river they have ever encountered that ran from north to south. It's easy for us now to laugh at their simple minds, but when your whole life, culture, and religion is based on the Great Nile, especially if you're a simple soldier, and you march to a new foreign land, and suddenly discover that, wait, there's another great river out there, and it flows to the opposite direction of the Nile, it would be like us today discovering life on another planet who didn't need oxygen or water to survive. They were so baffled that they called this great, strange river Wijib Itaru, the inverted water. Although Thutmose didn't face any major resistance from the locals, he did encounter something totally unexpected. An army of another state, also looking to expand. That army belonged to another rising power in the region, the Mitanni. And they weren't just a band of raiders. It was an organized force, armed with weapons, armor, and chariots. And soon, a battle ensued. Although victorious, such an encounter must have shocked Thutmose and the Egyptians, who now knew that they weren't the only power in that region anymore. And if they wanted to expand, well, they would have to fight for it. Before departing back south, Thutmose erected a monument commemorating the event. Thutmose I also campaigned in the south, extending Egyptian influence as far as the Fourth Cataract. He also made great efforts to strengthen Egypt's control over Nubia, and firmly integrate it by establishing new provinces, appointing Egyptian governors, and conscripting native Nubians to the army. Thutmose is also notable in that he is considered the first pharaoh to be buried in the famous Valley of the Kings. Thutmose I died after a reign lasting about 13 years. His two eldest sons predeceased him, and he was succeeded by his youngest son, Thutmose II. Thutmose II's reign is not well documented, and from what is known, it seems to have been an uneventful one. Being the youngest child, Thutmose II wasn't groomed for the role of pharaoh, and from the course of events that followed, and some logic, it seems that at that time already, the real power behind the throne was held by his half-sister, slash wife, slash high priestess of Amun, Hatshepsut. We don't even know the nominal lengths of Thutmose II's reign, with estimates ranging from 5 to 15 years. With his death, he was supposed to have been succeeded by his young son, also named Thutmose. Yes, that Thutmose. His auntie, however, had other plans. Hatshepsut, an obviously capable, intelligent, and a very ambitious woman, was able to name herself first as regent, itself being a breaking of protocol, as usually the heir's mother was expected to fill that role, and then as full-fledged co-pharaoh. Although she wasn't the first or last woman to effectively rule Egypt, Hatshepsut would surpass them all, assuming all of the regalia and symbols of the pharaoh in all official representations, the foremost being the traditional false beard. These she was able to do with a combination of bribing some, intimidating others, propaganda, and the good old divine origin story, circulating a story of herself being the daughter of the god Amun and being chosen by him to rule Egypt. Her power and abilities, however, went far beyond simple court politics, and her reign is considered to be one of Egypt's greatest and most prosperous. The most notable achievements of her reign were the trade expedition to the rich and exotic land of Punt, usually identified with modern-day Somalia and eastern Ethiopia, and many great construction projects, the most notable of whom was the mortuary temple complex of Deir el-Bahari. Militarily, her reign was mostly peaceful, especially when compared to that of her predecessors. Now, despite what most may think, The relationship between Hatshepsut and then Thutmose seems to have been quite amicable. Thutmose, on the one hand, was a smart kid and knew that it would be very difficult to overthrow his capable aunt from power. He probably also admired and respected his obviously wise and capable aunt, and learned a great deal from her. Hatshepsut, on the other hand, knew that Thutmose will eventually ascend the throne, and she wanted her legacy to go beyond just a successful reign, but also a successful succession. And she seems to have made sure that the young Thutmose be properly tutored for kinship and had him trained from a young age in the arts of war. When he began to show signs of his capabilities, she went so far as to appoint him as leader of her armies. The appointment to such a powerful position, and the fact that Thutmose didn't take advantage of this position, I mean, the guy now commanded Egypt's armies and was the rightful heir, are evidence for the mutual respect the two held for each other. We must also remember that the fact Hatshepsut herself didn't have a male heir was probably a major reason for this as well. When Hatshepsut died, Thutmose III, aged around 22, finally became sole pharaoh. And just like his grandfather, Thutmose III seems to have been a soldier at heart. He seems to have definitely looked the part. From his mummy, Egyptologists were able to conclude that his height was above 1.7 meters, taller than the average Egyptian for that period. This, combined with his militaristic upbringing and lineage, probably means that the new pharaoh was a formidable figure on the battlefield. His reign would see him personally leading an unprecedented 17 campaigns. 17! That's an average of one campaign every 2 years. No pharaoh would even come close to such a number. A major source for Thutmose's reign and conquests was, well, a sort of a personal diary of the king himself, in which he described most of his campaigns. That diary, the Annals of Thutmose III, can be found on the inside walls at the Great Karnak Temple. Measuring 25 meters in length and 12 meters wide, they contain the largest and most detailed accounts concerning military exploits of all Egyptian kings. Thutmose's first campaign occurred soon after Hatshepsut's death. Northern Canaanite towns, nominal vassals of Egypt, have stopped paying tribute. News also arrived that they were now under the influence and threats of the Syrian town of Kadesh, and had allied with it and other Syrian towns. The town of Kadesh was located in what is today western Syria, close to the border with Lebanon. The town lay close to the Orontes River. A rising local power, Kadesh formed and led a coalition that sought to fend off the foreign Egyptian influence. I uploaded a map showing the location of Kadesh on the podcast's Facebook and Instagram pages. Yes, the podcast now has an Instagram page. Thutmose III moved fast. How fast? The news of the rebellion were received around the end of February or the beginning of March. By the beginning of May, Thutmose had reached the town of Yehem, modern-day central Israel. It seems he acted fast so as to attack his enemies during the harvest season, when most levies were in the field. His target was the town of Megiddo, which had joined the rebellion and where the enemy forces were now gathering. The word Armageddon comes from the words Har Megiddo, or Mount Megiddo, since according to the Bible, the final battle between good and evil will be fought on the same fields Thutmose was now marching towards. We are told by the annals that Thutmose and his army had three possible routes. Two safe routes that went around the mountains that lay ahead, and one route that went through the Aruna Pass, modern-day Wadi Ara, described as a narrow mountain pass that would take them straight to Megiddo behind the enemy. Thutmose's commanders strongly argued against the latter, but the pharaoh, as is boasted in the inscription, accused them of cowardice and decided to take the Aruna Pass, personally leading the army through it. However it went, the decision to take the riskier route paid off, as the enemy had thought that the Egyptians would take the safer routes and left the Aruna Pass, a perfect location for an ambush, totally unguarded, and Thutmose and his army suddenly appeared behind the Canaanite army and in front of the now undefended Megiddo. The Battle of Megiddo, that would be fought the next day, is considered to be the first reliably recorded battle, and as such, it will be the first battle that I'll be able to actually talk about. It's really exciting for the history geek in me, it really is. In the morning of the next day, the two armies arrayed. We don't have any reliable estimates of the number of the troops involved. They seem to have been evenly matched, with estimates ranging from 1,000 to over 10,000 men, with up to 1,000 chariots on each side. However, the fact that Tahutmose set out from Egypt in a relative hurry means that he couldn't have gathered his full force, so he probably had with him a couple of thousand men, perhaps up to 5,000, with a couple hundred chariots. I'll talk a bit about the warfare and tactics used at that time. The most important weapons the Egyptians had were the chariot and the composite bow. The Egyptian chariot was based on the Hyksos design, themselves originally Canaanites. The Egyptian chariot, however, was upgraded to be far lighter and more maneuverable. The chariot wasn't used, as many would think, as a sort of an ancient tank to charge directly at the enemy formations. Instead, the chariot was used as a fast, mobile shooting platform with two men on it, one who would drive it and the other to shoot arrows, javelins, and if needed, defend the chariot with a spear. The chariot was also used as a psychological weapon, as the whizzing sound of hundreds of chariots would frighten the enemy soldiers. The Egyptian composite bow was the second major weapon of the Egyptians. It gave the Egyptian soldiers an unparalleled range from which they could attack their enemies, either as foot archers or from the chariots. The battle would usually begin with, and usually be determined by, chariot maneuvers. Both armies would usually send their chariots to either engage with the enemy or to drive in front of the enemy lines, constantly shooting arrows. The side that would usually get the upper hand here would usually win the battle. The last aspect I'll talk about here is the infantry. Ancient infantry, as with later infantry, didn't fight like most, including me, would imagine them fighting. Hundreds and thousands of men charging at one another with this huge clash of the front ranks and just slaughter everywhere. What would usually happen is that after the initial skirmishing of both sides, the infantry lines would advance at one another until a gap of about 3 to 5 meters between them would form. What would follow is, well, you can call it a cursing face-off. Most of the soldiers would simply stand there, throwing insults, giving out some rude hand gestures, while some would try to lead sporadic charges into the enemy lines, looking out for some weakness or fatigue, perhaps enough to lead a major breakthrough. The major charge of the infantry would usually come when such a breakthrough is achieved, or in most cases, when the army is routing or fleeing, and that's the part when most of the casualties would be incurred. Okay, back to our battle. As the two armies faced one another, the order of battle would have mostly followed the description I gave earlier. The day was eventually won by Tahutmose III and the Egyptians, not only due to their superior organization, weaponry, and leadership, but also due to the fact that the Canaanites were fighting downhill. Yep, fighting with chariots as your main weapon is probably one of the few cases in which controlling the high ground is a disadvantage, both for attack, as it's harder to control your chariot, but also for fleeing, as you're fleeing uphill with your horses already tired and panicking. So complete was the rout of the Canaanites that they simply left their chariots on the battlefield and ran on foot. Upon seeing this, the rest of the Canaanite army simply broke, fleeing to the nearby town of Megiddo. Tahutmose's plan was to pursue the enemy quickly, taking the gates and gaining access to the town. His plan, however, was foiled, when instead, his soldiers began plundering the enemy's camp and captives, allowing those who fled, including most of the coalition leaders, to regroup behind the walls of Megiddo. Denied his quick victory, Tahutmose III, to his great annoyance, settled in for a siege. Megiddo was well fortified, with high thick walls and a water spring inside the town. Being that the Egyptians never mastered siege warfare, all they could do was to starve it out. The Egyptians quickly encircled the city, cut any tree and orchard in the area in order to construct a palisade, and waited. Being that all the coalition leaders seemed to have been stuck inside the town, no help from the outside was coming. After making sure all his orders were followed, Thutmose appointed the general to take command of the siege, and returned to Egypt to attend other matters. 7 months later, Megiddo fell. With the fall of Megiddo, Canaan was mostly pacified, while the Syrian towns, foremost among them Kadesh, were humbled. Unlike his predecessors, however, Thutmose III wanted more than mere tribute and vassalage. Thutmose wanted outright conquest. All those leaders and nobles previously mentioned were sent as captives to Thebes. There, they were made to bow and swear an oath of allegiance to the throne of Egypt. And just in case the oath were not full-hearted, a hostage was demanded, usually in the form of the sons of these rulers. Now, I wouldn't pity them too much. It's not like they were kept in a cell. They were treated as nobles and lived in the court of probably the richest country in the world at that time. The purpose of such captivity was double. The first and obvious one was to keep their fathers and relatives from breaking their oath of loyalty. The second was to introduce these youngsters to Egyptian culture, language, and traditions, hopefully Egyptizing them so that when it was their time to rule, they would be more loyal to the pharaoh and spread Egyptian culture in the conquered areas. In the conquered areas, Egyptian governors were appointed and military garrisons established. To further consolidate Egyptian control over Canaan, Thutmose III launched the second to fourth campaigns. These were more of military tours, whose aim was less to fight or conquer and more to consolidate the gains of the first campaign and make it clear to the locals that Egyptian power was here to stay. It is mentioned that some towns resisted. These, however, were quickly taken and sacked. The major rulers and nobles who hadn't already submitted were made to submit and likewise send hostages. The 5th to 7th campaigns were directed against Phoenicia. The 5th to 7th campaign were directed against Phoenicia. Many towns in that area had already been in the Egyptian sphere of influence for centuries. Chief amongst them was Byblos, which was so influenced by Egypt at that time that some describe it as an Egyptian colony. It was definitely important for Egypt to maintain close relationship with Byblos, as it was its main source of the famous cedar wood, as well as giving them a strong ally in that area, and a safe port which Thutmose would use. Sailing directly to Egypt from Byblos, Thutmose followed the same drill he had in Canaan. Towns were subdued, hostages sent to Egypt, and more allies of Kadesh and the other Syrian towns brought into the fold. Not just politically, but also economically and commercially, further isolating and impoverishing them. These campaigns, however, had other purposes. First, to drill his army and get it acquainted with these mostly foreign areas in which they were going to operate. Second, to establish a logistical infrastructure in northern Canaan and Phoenicia by guaranteeing supplies from the local towns, establishing supply depots, and laying roads, all in preparation for facing the greatest enemy Egypt would face to date, the Mitanni. The Mitanni were the other great power of the area, who had already contended with Egyptian influence and power. From what we know about the Mitanni, they spoke an Indo-European language, and their state seems to have been less centralized than Egypt. At that point, they were the only power in that region who were able to challenge Thutmose. If Thutmose wanted to expand his empire in that area, he knew that a conflict with the Mitanni was inevitable. Also, it seems that the rebellions of the Syrians and northern Canaanites were encouraged and perhaps supported by the Mitanni. Thutmose III still had a score to settle with Kadesh and the other Syrian towns. He may have defeated them in the field, but the northern stronghold and its allies still resisted Egyptian power, and if given the chance, they would attack. Thutmose III was a military man, and knew that any campaign against the Mitanni required proper preparations and logistics. It would be far more difficult and complicated than the usual incursions into Canaan, and would take him and his army farther than any Egyptian army before. Thus we reached Thutmose III's greatest and largest campaign, and the one best described in his annals, the Eighth Campaign. What made this campaign so special were its scope and scale, not just by ancient standards. More than 10,000 troops were assembled in Egypt. These in turn would be transported along with their gear, horses, and chariots to Byblos by a large fleet of several hundred ships, meaning that Thutmose III had to expand and reorganize the mostly river-based Egyptian navy. The Egyptian army sailed from the Nile Delta towards Byblos. Imagine the look on the faces of the people of Byblos as this massive fleet was spotted on the horizon. Thutmose III spent about a month in Byblos, making sure that as much wood as possible is brought to his engineers who were preparing a surprise for the Mitanni. When he was ready, he set out from Byblos. His first target was the city-state of Qatna. Qatna was first mentioned in our podcast in the episode about Hammurabi, in which it was mentioned as one of the last independent kingdoms of that area, after the conquests of Hammurabi. By Thutmose's campaigns, however, the city had declined and was a Mitanni vassal. Seeing the large Egyptian army, the ruler of Qatna changed sides and agreed to become a vassal of Egypt. It is even mentioned that he and Thutmose had a narrow shooting competition. This vassalage would last until the death of Thutmose III. Thutmose's next target is not so clear. It may have been a town called Tunip, which was also made to switch to the Egyptian side through diplomacy. A notable exception in this campaign is Kadesh. It seems that despite all his power, Kadesh was simply too well fortified and too well supplied for Thutmose to attack and besiege. So, his strategy was to simply bypass it, completely surrounding it on all sides, at least weakening it and perhaps isolating it into submission. Then came the next and main part of the campaign. Thutmose III marched as fast as he could towards the Euphrates in order to catch the Mitanni completely off guard. They stopped for a few days at the ancient city of Aleppo and subdued the town of Carchemish, plundering it and taking hostages. Upon reaching the great river, Thutmose III revealed the surprise he had his engineers prepare in Byblos. Dozens of small cedar boats designed for a river crossing were deployed, allowing a quick crossing of the Egyptian army. By the time the Mitanni were even aware that this huge Egyptian army had crossed the mighty Euphrates, Thutmose and his army had already started sacking and burning settlements on the eastern bank. A small force assembled in haste by the Mitanni was defeated, and for 2 weeks, the Egyptian army basically did whatever they wanted. If Thutmose III wanted a decisive victory, it was denied from him. It seems that the very speed of his attack prevented the Mitanni from assembling their full army, preventing a great decisive battle. Still, this campaign was a great achievement for Thutmose and the Egyptians. The next time that an Egyptian army would cross the Euphrates would be more than 1,000 years later, during the reign of the Ptolemies. Eventually, Thutmose decided it was time to head back. After crossing the river, Thutmose erected a great monument commemorating his crossing next to the one erected by his grandfather. Unfortunately, the two monuments of victory are now lost. As for the boats, they were carefully disassembled and carried back, as good strong wood was a valuable commodity in Egypt. After passing through Carchemish and Aleppo, Thutmose decided to change course and march through central Syria, plundering some more settlements. After reaching a region called Nia, Thutmose is described as engaging in the royal activity of hunting. It is mentioned that 120 Asian elephants and 7 lions were hunted, which, beyond the glory attributed to hunting these great animals, provided a great amount of ivory to the campaign's plunder. Finally, Thutmose and his army traveled by foot to Egypt. Although 9 more campaigns will be launched in the future, none of them would match the scale and glory attributed to the 8th campaign. Although no decisive victory over the Mitanni was scored, Phoenicia and Syria up to the Euphrates were firmly in Egyptian hands, except of course for the stubborn but now isolated Kadesh. And Tahutmos had shown that if needed, the Euphrates was no longer a safe barrier and that his army could attack wherever and whenever needed. This campaign set the Euphrates as the northernmost border of Egypt, and no attempt for expansion beyond it will be made until the time of the Ptolemies. On the world or regional stage, this campaign was definitely a success, as it is recorded that emissaries from many lands as far as Assyria, Babylon, and Hatti came to Egypt to acknowledge the power of Thutmose III and ask his friendship, offering gifts and even princesses for diplomatic marriages. Next came the 9th and 10th campaigns, which were again more of a military tours in the recently subjugated areas. But while the 9th campaign went relatively quiet, the 10th campaign didn't. While touring in Syria, with a far smaller army than in the 8th campaign, it was the Mitanni's turn to make a surprise attack. Crossing the Euphrates, they attacked the area around Aleppo, catching the Egyptians by surprise. Gathering his troops, with whatever reinforcements he could muster, Thutmose raced north. There, another battle was fought with the Mitanni, which, although described as a victory by Thutmose, seems to have been more of a stalemate. Still, even when caught off guard and relatively unprepared, Thutmose III held his ground and denied victory from his enemies. After this campaign, we could say that the border between the Egyptian and Mitanni sphere of influence was set at the Euphrates. The next 11th to 14th campaigns were taken by Thutmose III to further consolidate Egyptian territory south of the Euphrates and extend it to the few areas that have, until now, escaped Egyptian influence. Notable amongst these was the coastal town of Ugrait, that, with its capture, Thutmose now controlled all Syrian, Phoenician, and Canaanite ports. Thutmose III's last great campaigns, the 15th and 16th campaigns, were launched in response to a rebellion of the Syrian cities, led by, of course, Kadesh, along with Tunip, and again, encouraged by the Mitanni. In the first campaign, Thutmose marched north by land. He may have chosen the land route over the sea route in order to deter any potential rebellion in Canaan and Phoenicia. Gathering reinforcements as he traveled north, he spent this campaign defeating and mopping up Mitanni forces sent to help out the rebels. Next year, Thutmose returned for his final Syrian campaign, this time with the clear goal of subduing Kadesh. After capturing Tunip, he surrounded and besieged Kadesh, and this time he wasn't going back until the great stubborn town would fall. After what was no doubt a long siege, Kadesh was taken and plundered. But despite what one may expect, no brutal or special treatment of the town is mentioned. At the end of this campaign, Thutmose was about 44 years old. This would be his last campaign in Canaan and Syria, and throughout the rest of his reign, the area will remain mostly quiet. Before I talk about the 17th and final campaign and reach the end of this episode, I'll talk a bit about the non-military aspect of Thutmose III. After all, let's not forget that in between all this campaigning, not only did Thutmose had an empire to run, it was the largest in Egypt's history, and he seems to have did a pretty darn good job in that as well. The centralization of the state continued as befitting the soldier pharaoh. The maintenance of a large standing army and the constant campaigning required a larger, yet more organized bureaucracy and tax collection. Trade continued and extended to new lands, further encouraged by exotic tributes sent by kings and rulers to the ruler of the greatest kingdom in the world. Construction was also done on a massive scale, perhaps not surpassed by any Egyptian pharaoh, except for the later Ramses II. Not just monuments and temples, but also forts and garrison to support the conquests. A notable beneficiary of the great pharaoh's building spree was the Karnak Temple complex, which was both renovated and greatly expanded. Notable in this expansion was the carving and the erection of the two tallest obelisks in Egyptian history, the Lateran Obelisk, today located in Rome, and the Obelisk of Theodosius, today located in Istanbul. Last, I will talk about the most controversial issue of Thutmose's reign, the erasing of Hatshepsut's memory. In the later part of his reign, Thutmose III ordered the removal of Hatshepsut's memory from every monument and temple throughout Egypt. Every mention or image of her was either destroyed, changed as to give credit to Thutmose, or simply dismantled and reused. Finally, Thutmose III had the mummy of his grandfather, the great Thutmose I, removed and reinterred in a new tomb so as to discredit the tomb constructed by Hatshepsut and give his great-grandfather a proper resting place. Well, throughout history, people thought that this was made out of a grudge held by Thutmose III. In recent years, this view has changed. Most scholars and experts today believe that the reason for these acts were out of concern of Thutmose for the succession issue. You see, Thutmose III had one surviving son, Amenhotep II, who was about 6 years old around the time of these acts of defacement. With the ascension of Thutmose I, two royal lineages were formed. The first was through his marriage to a lesser wife, through which Thutmose II and Thutmose III were descended. The second lineage was through his royal wife, through whom Hatshepsut was descended, and which seems to have had other remaining members, who in the eyes of some had a stronger claim than the descendant of Thutmose II. If Thutmose III died while Amenhotep was still underage, who knew what could happen? Perhaps his line would be overthrown through a claim of descent of the mighty Hatshepsut. By removing her from the public knowledge, as if she never existed, and portraying himself as sole ruler, there would be no descent to rely on for legitimacy. I can't but think that a small part of Thutmose III, especially in the later part of his life, did hold some grudge for his aunt Hatshepsut, who, well, let's face it, sidelined him for 20 years, although none of the surviving records hint at this. After some peaceful years, Thutmose seems to have grown bored with the court routine and felt the yearn for the good old military days. The problem was, well, that there was no one to fight. As I said earlier, the north remained quiet for the most part, and to the south, Nubia seems to have been fully pacified and incorporated to the empire at this point. Still, Thutmose III decided to head south, being that he hadn't campaigned in that area. He took with him a small force, perhaps no more than 1,000 men, and probably took his now teenage son Amenhotep for some father-son activities. This campaign, the so-called 17th campaign, didn't have any fighting in it, as Thutmose and his small force marched throughout Nubia, inspecting the implementation of the royal policy, initiating some construction projects, and doing some touring. They reached as far south as the Fourth Cataract, marking the southernmost point ever reached by an Egyptian army. Finally, aged around 56, and after about a 54-year-long reign, of whom 34 were of sole personal rule, Thutmose III, Egypt's greatest warrior pharaoh, died. In his last 2 years, he appointed his sole surviving son and heir, Amenhotep II, as co-ruler, boosting his legitimacy and preparing him for the task of ruling Egypt. He had come to power at the head of an Egypt that was at a crossroads, between its traditionally inward, isolationist character and past, and a new outward-looking future. It was Thutmose III who firmly chose to put it on the later path, and left it as a true powerful and multi-ethnic empire, the envy of all neighboring states. Egypt at this point was at the height of its political, military, and economic power, and probably the strongest state in the world, and it would go on to enjoy more than 2 centuries of prosperity and power. All these might not have occurred had it not been for Thutmose III, the Napoleon of Egypt. Thank you all for listening to the Conquerors Podcast. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate it and press the subscribe button. Your reviews and comments are most welcome. You can leave them on the podcast's Facebook page called The Conquerors Podcast, a YouTube channel with the same name, or on iTunes or any platform you guys use to listen. As I mentioned earlier, the podcast now has an Instagram page, which you could also follow. You can also contact me directly at theconquerorspodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to check out the Timur Podcast. I will eventually get to Timur, who was one of the greatest conquerors in history, and anyone who listens to this podcast will enjoy listening to it, as James does an awesome job. Join us next time as we travel back to Mesopotamia, to the background episode of, in my opinion, the most fearsome and brutal conquerors of the ancient world, other than the Romans, the Assyrians.